All righty, here we go. Friday morning, All Saints Day. Hope you had a great Halloween and that everybody was safe and you got a lot of candy and all that kind of stuff. Today, it's raining already this morning. I'll tell you what, today is November 1st, and it felt outside with the humidity. It was 73 degrees like it did the night that Francine passed through. It was that hot and humid, and it's November 1st. So I say this not to have an argument about climate change, but for those of you who, through your thought process, would text me when it's 40 degrees on December 15th and say, where's your climate change? Well, if that's your logic, then you would then have to say me, text me today and say, well, apparently if it's going to be 81 degrees on November 1st, then there's something to it. Highs in 82 today, 82 through the weekend, then going up to 85 next week. Maybe a cold front by next Saturday to bring it down the highs to mid-70s, which is hardly from cold. Presidential election on Tuesday. Matt McCorkle joins us now, a professor of the practice at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good, good.
What's going on? You are on the ground in North Carolina, are you not?
I am. Very tight race.
How has, I get them confused, Helene, I guess it is, right, factored into this?
Yes, 25 to 30 counties have been significantly affected in the West. That is usually a stronghold of Republican vote. But Asheville, Buncombe County, was also devastated. And that's a Democratic stronghold. So it's unclear. It appears that people in early voting are voting more than a lot of experts thought. So we'll have to see. A lot of people at first thought that that might be a problem for the Republicans, but that's unclear.
So you got the logistics, right? The pragmatic part of it, the political part of it. Trump, I think, was in North Carolina saying that, going back to the Biden thing with the garbage, which, you know, you're garbage, I'm garbage, no, I'm garbage, you're garbage, we're all garbage. I don't know where it stands today, but
yes,
telling the people of North Carolina that the current administration was treating them like they're garbage. The question I'm asking you is, there in North Carolina, is that message resonating with people? Because the governor said that, no, they're getting everything they need from the federal government, and it just seems as though the Trump campaign are the people pushing that message, not... I don't know. Tell me what the feeling is on.
It's part of the extreme Trump message that you would think would be risky. But a number of local Republicans, as they have in other states, have said, no, there is no problem, you know, with the federal government's response. But this is, you know, Donald Trump is not the qualifier or the precision candidate. So, you're right. I mean, he's the one who said the United States had turned into a floating pile of garbage before his comic said that Puerto Rico had. So it's hard to gauge because it's just not like any other conventional politician.
What I find interesting about that is that just having been through Katrina here, right, and knowing what it's like, I guess it goes to everybody's going to be disrupted after a storm like that, right? I know what it was like here, and I'm just wondering, going back then, would I look through it as, all right, the storm, this is a massive storm that devastated a lot of different things, and nothing's going to come back right away, or would I look at it through, this is my guy, this is my woman, this is who I decide to follow, and then, therefore, I'm going to let them dictate my feelings as to the response. Do you understand what I'm trying to ask you?
Exactly. And that's, you know, what that has allowed Trump, or has created for former President Trump, perhaps the strongest political base of supporters that we've ever seen. The question is for him, let's say that's 40%, 40, even maybe a little bit more. Can he get to 50? And that, you know, can he get to a majority? Can people who aren't so attracted to that message swing to Trump? And I think that's the big question for this election.
Let me take a break. We'll come back, talk about the path to 270, because I heard a political scientist on TV here saying, you know, the Republicans, I think, by a higher percentage, vastly voted early here in Louisiana, and the political scientist was guessing that was because they wanted to really run up the score for Trump, because Louisiana is solid red in our eight electoral votes. But if people in states where it's not contested feel as though their vote is wasted, or what effect that has on them traditionally if they don't even turn out to vote, and also because it is all about the Electoral College, give me some different paths for each candidate as we talk about these swing states of Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada. We're talking to Mac McCorkle, our friend, professor of the practice at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy, about the presidential election. 621 traffic now, WWL. All right, 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Mac McCorkle, professor of the practice at Duke University's Terry Sanford School of Public Policy. He's in North Carolina, a swing state, and we're talking about the presidential election on Tuesday. So, professor, let's talk about, it's all about the electoral votes, popular vote. Okay, if you want to keep score, that's fine, but it doesn't really matter. Let's talk about each candidate's path to 270 and these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 swing states, right?
Yes, yes. Well, the easiest way to understand it is that the Democratic path, the path for Vice President Harris, you take the traditionally blue states, Massachusetts, Vermont, California, New York, the traditionally blue states, plus the states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, and the Democrat winning those gets to 270. There's a little.
Wait, let me slow you down a little bit. Michigan, Wisconsin,
Pennsylvania, in combination with traditionally blue states that people think are usually in the Democratic column, those are the three states that Trump won in 2016 and lost in 2020. If Harris wins those three states and wins the traditionally Democratic states, she gets to 270. The little kink there is that in Nebraska and Maine, she needs to win districts, one district in each state to get there. So she can lose, even though Biden won Nevada, Arizona, Georgia. Trump won North Carolina. So that's the variation. Trump needs to break into the blue state, into the blue wall of Wisconsin, Michigan, or Pennsylvania. If he gets one of those states, then Harris has to repeat the Biden victory somewhere else and gain of a state like North Carolina.
When it comes to, I'm sorry, do you have something else, Professor? I didn't mean to cut you off.
No.
You know one thing I want to talk about? We talk about swing states, right, and how the other states like Louisiana, it really doesn't matter when it comes to the presidential race because we're solid red, as is Arkansas, Oklahoma. Texas, I'm looking at this map here, and they got that in pink. Is Texas really in play?
Democrats always wish it was in play. And they do have a strong senatorial candidate in all red who's a former Dallas Cowboy. Mm-hmm. But let's just put it this way. If Texas is really, really competitive and Harris has a chance there, it's going to be a very big night for Democrats. I would be surprised.
If Harris carries Texas, then you got some eyebrows raised, and then that, I think, would really send a message to the Republicans. Now, conversely, what would send a message to the Democrats if Trump were to carry, say, I don't know, pick a state that would be
Virginia and New Hampshire.
Okay. So if Trump were to carry Virginia and New Hampshire, that would send a message to the Democrats that the country, or at least that the movement is very much in, how can I phrase this? It'd be the same thing as Harris winning Texas.
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the swing districts in the swing states, because Maine and Nebraska allocates electoral votes differently than do the other states. Talk a little bit about that, if you would, Professor. And then, when you talk about the districts, how many people are we talking about here?
Well, it's done by population. It's a congressional district. They do it by congressional district. So Maine has two districts. And Nebraska has two districts. The district that is Omaha, more urban and university townish, is the one that goes Democratic. And then the Portland area in Maine is the one that goes Democratic. The Republicans were thinking about trying to get trying to change that so that they apportion their votes statewide, whoever won statewide. And one Republican who had said no, and so they weren't able to do it.
So if you had to look into your crystal ball, a McCorkle crystal ball that's been handed down from generation to generation. Come on, Mac. You know, you keep it in it's a mahogany case, blue velvet, padded, and then in a bag. You take it out, you polish it off, you look into it. Tell me where we're going to be next Friday, as a matter of fact. Next Friday, November 8th, where we're going to be.
Well, North Carolina will come in should come in fast. We've already had over half of the states, what they think is about half the vote is already in. If you see Harris winning North Carolina, which barely went for Trump last time, you can assume it's going to be a big night for Harris.
Say that one more time.
If Harris wins North Carolina, and that should be a somewhat early indication.
Result, okay.
Then that's going to be a big night for Harris. If you see the other town, for instance, Virginia should come in pretty quickly. If Virginia comes in for Trump, it's going to be a big Trump night. The real issue is that Republicans have been coming out in early voting, which is a good strategy. It was always risky for Republicans to wait to the last day. But what appears to be happening is, and again, we can't exactly tell, but the seems like an overwhelming number of women versus men voting so far.
Professor, we got to run. I'm out of time. I appreciate it. I hope we get to talk to you again.
Right.
So look, if Trump carries Virginia, it'll be a big night for Trump. If Harris carries North Carolina, it'll be a big night for Harris, right?
Correct.
Thank you, Professor. A little bit late time for WWL First News. Quickly to Dave Cohen. 6:46, 14 before 7, as a friend texted me a couple of minutes ago, an overly warm Friday morning for November 1st, but what are you going to do? Highs are going to be around 80 or so, then in the mid-80s by next week, and hopefully cooling by next Saturday. But by cooling, we're talking about highs in the mid-70s, which is better than this. And it's rainy out there, so be careful. Walter Dublane joins us, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. Talk about tariffs.
Good morning, Tommy.
Morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm good.
How's everything at UNO?
Well, we're hanging in there. So.
That's all you can do. God bless y'all, because I know you did a lot for me. Let's talk about tariffs. Former President Trump says that tariffs are the answer. Companies, I see stories, are ready to raise prices. Tell us what a tariff is, how it works out, and who winds up paying for it.
Well, a tariff is just a tax. And just like any other tax, it raises the cost of the goods to the consumer. Now, this is only taxing goods that come from abroad, is what a tariff does. So if you tax Chinese goods, that means that the price of the Chinese good goes up. And the whole purpose of it is to to get people to buy American goods, but the net effect is that the price goes up. So the consumer, for the most part, pays taxes. Unless it was a pure monopoly, that would be a little different story. But in a general competitive market, when tariff pays taxes, the taxes gets passed on to the consumer.
So let me take some case studies here, Dub. Maybe that would help us understand a little bit better. Let's take clothing, let's take appliances, and let's take, automobile tires. And I don't know what's made where or whatever products are made, or maybe we should start the other way first by talking about what products are made and being imported that could be targeted by tariffs.
Well, again, like I say, most of the clothing we do is made abroad. A lot, it used to be made a lot in China. A lot of it has moved down to the Philippines and Vietnam and Bangladesh these days because the wage rates have gone up in China, and so they've gone to cheaper places. But again, those things like particularly, T-shirts and stuff like that, which require a lot of just people sitting at a sewing machine labor, that's where they go to someplace in the world that has cheaper labor. Boston used to be the headquarters of cheap labor in the U.S., and that's clearly not the case these days.
So if we're going to talk about clothing that's made outside in Vietnam, a lot of clothing that I get, I think the jacket I'm wearing right now was made in Vietnam. bought from an American place. So American suppliers, American wholesalers, however you want to phrase it, Joseph Banks, I think, is what this one is. So they buy this, they get this stuff made in Vietnam, and they sell it here. So if a tariff is in place, the jacket that I paid $200 for would go up to, say, what, a 20% tariff would be, what, 220 now?
240, but yes.
240, okay, I'm not a math guy. So, okay, it's 240,
thank you, Bob. And of course, I mean, Trump's talking, I mean, of course, he says lots of little things. You know, he's talking about, I'm going to put a 100% tariff on some things.
All right, well, so if that's the case, then it would be a $400 jacket, right?
Right. Okay. And again, I think he tends to be, he's focusing more on, well, he says manufactured good. I don't know that clothing is his big target.
What is it? What is a big target?
I think
target?
He has more in mind, you know, tractors and things like that.
So
but
let's
still.
Talk about that. Let me pick up tractors when we come back after the break. So
yeah.
If he's focusing tractors and say a 20% tariff, it would increase the cost of a tractor by 20%. That would be passed on to the consumer with the end goal of, well, heck, if we're going to pay 20% more for tractors, we may as well do it with American labor and have them manufactured here. Well, did that 20%, do those numbers add up in terms of increased cost of labor? If people are going to be paying 20% more, does that mean then that you could make a tractor in the United States and only cost 20% more? But either way, the person that buys that tractor is going to wind up paying 20% more. As I understand it, you can pick it up there. We come back, 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:55, quickly back to Walter Dublane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at UNO, talking about tariffs. So we can put a 20% tariff on an imported tractor, which means that the incentive is for people to start manufacturing them here, Dub, and stop importing tractors, yes?
Yeah, that's the point.
So does the math...
The only question is, who pays for that? And the answer is the people buying the tractors.
So does the math work out?
Exactly the whole 20%. You know, I mean, it could be the Americans now can produce it for 10% more and would be worthwhile. But the point is the price will go up, and the people that will pay for it is going to be the people that buy the tractors.
But a key part in this is, does it work? Does the math work with the percentage of the tariff to entice American companies to build tractors here? And then so what happens is they would be able to build tractors here and still make a profit. It would cost 20% more than it does now because they'd have to pay more for labor than the imported model, but there would be economic gains of that. However, the consumer would still have to pay for that. Am I on track here?
Yeah, and again, yes, that's the point. There's a sense in which it would work, except what you got to remember is the other half of it is if we're putting tariffs on their goods, they're going to do and do what's called reciprocal tariffs on our goods. And so the people are now we buy a lot for China. We buy a lot more from China than we send to them, but we send a lot of things to China. And now the manufacturers of the goods that we send abroad, they're going to be hurt because their prices are going to go up in China and they won't be buying from us anymore. So we'll help some industries, but we'll hurt other ones.
So I don't care if it's Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, Mitt Romney or Grover Cleveland, if they were to put tariffs on goods economically, does it work or can you not say it that generally? Does it depend on what country, what product, et cetera?
Well, yeah, there are some specific cases. And in fact, I think there are some cases for doing some tariffs on China because of certain unfair trade practices. But the thing that kind of worries me the most is he wants to start taxing all imports, you know, from Europe. That would be a killer. One of the things we know historically is that everybody gains from free trade. In general, free trade makes both parties richer. Now, sometimes there's certain industries that will gain, other industries will lose. But on average, everybody goes up before free trade. So a huge tariff policy will basically make us poorer is the net effect, as well as the other people.
So how does that factor in with inflation? Because if you do put tariffs on goods, it's going to end ultimately being paid for by the end user?
Yeah. So the tariffs will be, it's a raise in the cost of goods. That'll show a raise in prices, inflation. Yes, that would cause inflation.
So generally speaking, as an economist, you would say when it comes to tariffs,
that I'm in favor of keeping them down. Now, so there's some selected cases. I can say I think we can make a case for doing some things with China if we coordinate with some of our partners in Europe and stuff like that. But just tariffs in general, I mean, for instance, you know, the free trade agreement we signed with Mexico and Canada, used to be called NAFTA, that really helped. I mean, specific industries were hurt by that. There's absolutely no doubt. And the ones that are hurt are usually very visible. So in other words, it's like 80 industries get helped and one gets destroyed. And so you always pay attention to the one that gets destroyed. But in general, free tariffs make both parties better off.
Thank you.
Hurt certain individual industries.
Have a good weekend. Thank you. We'll talk to Jan Mueller about the Landry administration's tax plan.